Purple.com, sleep better for less. Number one in customer satisfaction 2 years in a row with Mattresses Online by J.D. Power Award. Pick the right mattress for you. The Purple Mattress Dual Layered Comfort Foam, Purple Hybrid Breathable Responsive Support, Purple Hybrid Premier, less pressure for dreamy floaty. The Ascent Adjustable Base to make it possible to work, read, and lounge in bed. Bundle up for big savings, 10% off premium bedding and cushion bundles, kids mattresses ultimately placed grid and softer form, best support for little sleepers. Enjoy no pressure support with free sheets and two pillows on select mattress purchase up to $247 value. Sleepy Jones or Purple Pajamas all day comfort with soft stretch and smart pajamas while you worry about breakfast. Some of the products are Purple Harmony Pillow, Double Seat Cushion, Purple and Gravity Weighted Blanket, Purple Duvet, Choose Purple for No Pressure Support. For everybody, 30 plus years and 35 patents, Comfort Gel Grid, technology originally created to make wheelchairs more comfortable than they remember beds. People love Purple, period. Pause PAWS. Typically comfy even for your fur baby. Good morning, here's chapter 17 of American Dirt by Janine Cummins. For both Lydia and the sisters, there's a constant tug of war between the gruesome feeling that there's something chasing them, that they must move quickly, and a physical hesitation for less than to move finally toward whatever unknown demons may loom in the road ahead. The castle de Monrenta they find in Celaya is a respite from that tug of war, and is such after a sleepless night outdoors for Lydia, a holy blessing without compare. It's only midday when they arrive. Luca and Rebecca play basketball in the yard, and no one else can join. Some complicated game with jumbled rules of their own devising. Lydia and Soledad sit quietly together, watching from a nearby bench. They help in the kitchen, listening to Las Noticias on television, and then Lydia naps. When she wakens, she watches her son playing dominoes with Rebecca. She notes how quickly that those two have bridged the gap between their respective ages, 8 and 14. Luca seems to have grown up, and Rebecca to have simplified quite neatly, so they meet seamlessly in the middle. It feels as though they've known each other forever, as though these girls have always been here, waiting to become a part of their lives. That night, Luca asks if he can snuggle in beneath Rebecca's arm in her bunk. It's not appropriate, Lydia draws a line. Luca knew it was a long shot anyway, but hardly any of the rules from his old life seemed to apply anymore, so he figured it was worth asking. He climbs in bed without complaint. Lydia hauls her backpack beneath the sheets by her feet and wraps a strap twice around her ankle. They all sleep soundly. Glory, glory to have a door with a lock. Soledad has told Lydia nothing of where she and her sister came from or what they endured. Lydia hasn't said nothing of her family's circumstances either, but there's that silent bond of knowing between them, regardless of a magic that's marginally maternal but entirely female. So it's not surprising that in this morning, the girl who seems much older than just the 18 months that separate her from her sister, and who's not typically so forthcoming about private matters regarding her body, confides to Lydia that she's pregnant. Taking her cue from Soledad, Lydia endeavors to deliver a response to this news in a calm, unvarnished manner. "Your baby will be a U.S. citizen," she whispers across the top of her coffee cup. Soledad shakes her head and stands up from the table to clear her baby. "The baby isn't mine," she says when she reaches her arms above her and her baggy t-shirt gazes her waist of her jeans. Her tummy is flat. It's still flat. That day and night at La Casa are so significant in their restorative value that in the weeks to come, when they think back to the halcyon memory of this place, their stay will seem much longer than it was. Like all priests in Mexico, the padre here runs La Casa, wears swagger street clothes, a yellow polo shirt, and a softened pair of blue jeans with a tar stain on one leg. His only religious adornment is a simple wooden cross that hangs from a leather cord around his neck. He is slender with gray hair and glasses. There are more than 20 migrants resuming their journey today, and the padre gathers them in the yard before they leave. He gives a speech that literally thinks of as a kind of pep talk with the identity crisis, because he means to encourage them, but there's no pep in his talk. He stands on an upturned milk crate in front of the gathered crowd, and mostly he warns them, if it's possible for you to turn back, do so now. If you can go home again and make a life for yourself where you came from, if you can return there safely, I implore you, please do so now. If there is any other place for you to go, to stay away from these trees, to stay away from El Norte, go there now. Luca has his arm around Rebecca's waist, his head leaning in, her arm around his shoulder. Lydia looks at their faces. They do not flinch to these hard words. Some of the other migrants shift their weight nervously beneath them. If it's only a better life you seek, seek it elsewhere. The Padre continues, this path is only for people who have no choice, no other option, only wise and music behind you, and your journey will grow even more treacherous from here. Everything is working against you to thwart you. Some of you will fall from the train. Many will be maimed or injured. Many will die. Many, many of you will be kidnapped, tortured, trafficked, or ransomed. Some will be lucky enough to survive all of that and make it far as Estados Unidos, only to experience the pleasure of dying alone in the desert beneath the sun, abandoned by a corrupt coyote or shot by a narco who doesn't like the look of you. Every single one of you will be robbed. Everyone, if you make it to El Norte, you will arrive penniless. That's a guarantee. Look around you. Go ahead. Look at each other. Only one out of three will make it to your destination alive. Will it be you? He points at a man in his 50s with a neatly trimmed beard and a fresh t-shirt. Si, senor, the man answers. Will it be you? He points to a woman about Leah's age with a silent Tyler on her hip. Si, senor, she says. Will it be you? He points at Luca. Lydia feels a crush of wild despair still over her, but Luca lifts his small fist in the air and shouts a response. Si, Sereyo. The speech does a jump and energizes the migrants, instilling their resolve, which in turn makes them restless and impatient during the long wait for the train. In the third hour, a few give up waiting and begin to walk. In the fourth to fifth hours, more follow. Luca, Lydia, and the girls head toward the western edge of the city and search for an overpass, but the only way they find is the only one they find is way too hard. Jumping from there would be suicide, so they search instead for a curve where the train might slow down. It's mid-afternoon by the time La Bestia finally arrives, and it's more crowded than they have seen it before. Even from a distance, Lydia can see the silhouette migrants atop the cars, it being much faster than when they boarded yesterday in San Miguel de Allende. Lydia nearly says they should wait. They're not going to make it. She wants to articulate her hesitation, but she's not quick enough, and now the train is too loud. The noise thunders into her bones. They all run, and she holds Lucas and Tully in her fist. The men atop the train shout down to them instructions and encouragement. Rebecca goes up first, and then Soledad, who reaches back for Luca. He grabs her with his free hand, and there's a terrifying moment when he's stretched between them, one on top with Soledad on the shrieking beast, and the other linked to Lydia racing beneath. He's like taffy, soft, and exposed, and then Lydia hurls his little arm toward the train, and he's up. Soledad has him, and then the men from above lifting. He is safe. Lydia runs, not yet relieved, not until she joins them there. She runs, and the train is picking up speed, and she's falling behind the ladder, and she can't keep up. And then a burst of panic makes her leg go like pistons, and she grabs at the metal bars, terrified the legs won't be able to maintain the speed, that they'll drop, that she'll go under. But this is not her day, because all at once, her feet have found the bottom rung, and her hands are only one rung above them, and the train is picking up speed so quickly now she can't believe the velocity. But her body, all four of her limbs are attached to the train now, and she's curled there at the bottom of the load like a bug. And she lets out one tiny sob of relief before she uncurls herself and, pushing it from the bottom rung, begins to climb. When she gets to the top, she reaches for Luca, and she straps him down quickly with the belt, and then she holds him and cries quietly into his hair until her heart begins to go. Lydia wants to keep Luca and her sisters to herself to set their little group apart from the others as a unit, but the men are so friendly, so eager to help. Too eager, she worries. There aren't many women on La Bestia and very few children, so Lydia knows every single man they see. She's aware that she and her carriage represent something to these men. They look like home, or they look like salvation, or they look like prey to an halcon. They might look like reward money, and even if none of that were true, the two sisters cause a stir wherever they go, just by the very presence of their faces. Little distracted by these observations, which is why despite her constant watchfulness, she doesn't immediately notice the boy near the other end of the train car watching her. But Luca does, as he remembers an effect, and the act of remembering his experiences, a strange, incongruous moment of satisfaction, a brief rush of endorphins he's never noticed before, but that his brain has been performing all his life, a slight chemical self-congratulatory pleasure for achieving this test of almost perfect recall. Luca has seen that face before. He recognizes the boy, or so even before the tattoo is visible from where the boy is suddenly cross-legged at the other end of the train car. Luca recollects it, a bloody sickle creeping out of the sock. The three drops of blood ink dripping from the blade. Luca shivers beneath the hot sun. The boy is staring at Mamie, and then as Luca watches him, he retrieves a phone from his pocket, scrolls down a little bit, and then looks back at Mamie again. Then he puts it in his pocket. Luca is paralyzed by fear. A moment passed before he could give wind to his voice. Mamie, he says simply, and he thinks he says it quietly, calmly, though his body is still strapped to the top of that train. It feels like a wild flap of panic. Mamie leans in, but not close enough. He flutters his hand so she understands. Come here, get closer. Do it quickly. Let us get closer to him. Mamie, I recognize someone. These words alone are not enough to send a slice of cold down Lydia's spine. Okay, she says, letting her brain to slow down. Okay, who is it? Her arms and legs feel like they've turned to liquid, but her fingers in one hand stay tightly curled around the grating. The other hand goes all the way to the chin, and her neck slips her index finger inside Sebastian's wedding. Don't look, Luca says. He's staring at you, at us. Lydia's mantra comes heroically crashing through her consciousness, generating the violent static of his new information. Don't think, her brain tells her. Okay, here, she repents. Ew. Luca leans so his lips graze the top of her ear. The boy from the first Casa del Migrante at Huehuetoca. Little breathes deeper. Okay, some boy they cross paths with her along the way. She feels relieved in the jelly-like roll of her shoulders. Oh, Luca, she says she wants to rub Amanda for scaring her to death, but how is she supposed to know what may or may not provoke a stampede of dread in the confusing wasteland of their new life? So she also wants to laugh, to kiss him, and to tell him not to worry so much. She puts her arm around him. It's fine, she says. It's okay. Don't you remember that really bad kid, that cholo who got kicked out of the castle for bothering that girl? He did something bad to her. Yes, she remembers. Oh, shit. The woman at breakfast claimed he was a sicario. Only moments ago, Lydia had dared to feel comforted by their unlikely progress. She'd allowed herself to indulge in a new fear of anonymous, indiscriminate threats. Now here is some sicario from God knows what cartel staring her down from 100 yards away. She looks at the other migrants, sees around them. Any one of them could be a narco. Any one of them could be a jardinero. She pulls herself over her legs so her face is nearly touching the grating in front of her, or rather her body does this without her mind instructing it to. In an instinct to hide herself, to melt into the scenery, to disappear, Luca leans down too. There's something else, he says, because he knows, although he doesn't understand how he knows it, but, or what it means, that there's something deeply unsettling about the tattoo. What is it? Lydia is ready for this information, whatever it is. She opens the door to a tattoo. He has a tattoo. Her machete is strapped to her shin beneath her pant leg. She can feel the cinch of the holster the way it presses into her skin. She whispers to Lydia, what sort of tattoo? Like a big knife, like a big curved knife, maybe, he says, with three drops of blood. Lydia's mouth goes dry, her fingers close, her body trembles from inside out, core to tip, beginning in her lungs. Okay, but to Luca, her face looks calm and impassive. Like a sickle, she sees. She needs, but does not want clarity. Like this, she traces the shape of it on the palm of his hand with a finger. Luca nods. Thank you for telling me, Mijo, he says. You did the right thing, good boy. She touches his ear. Before Lydia can formulate a plan, before she can storm this information, indeed, before she can even turn her face in the direction, Luca has indeed to glimpse the boy with a hard and narrow tattoo. There's a collective shriek and terrible commotion. Two cars up, then they turn instinctively in the direction of the clamor. Everyone holds their breath, and then almost immediately, with a long hoot of its whistle, the train enters a tunnel, and all is in darkness. Mamie, Luca screams. I'm here, Luca, girlfriend. I'm here, Mijo. What happened? I don't know, Mijo. I'm scared. I know, Mijo. It's okay. She reaches through the blood till it touches the soft fuzz at the back of his head. A tunnel is a short one. And soon they blast out into the daylight again, and the sisters who had been dozing in a small heap until the commotion sit up and blink roughly at each other. A weary Morse code. What happened? So they ask. There's still a lot of yelling coming from the car two ahead of theirs, and a couple of voices begin to emerge from the fray, louder than the others. One man is willing, Armano, Armano, Armano. And then he stands up on top of the train, and his companions grab him and pull him back down. And then a moment later, the scene repeats itself. He sees his airman to jump off, and now the story is jump back along the train alone until it gets to the cluster of men seated in front of the sisters. One man turns to share it. His brother fell off, swallowed out of grass, and crosses herself. Dios mio, how? Yeah. The man points back at the tunnel they just passed through. Didn't see the tunnel. Was sitting up too tall on his knees, and bang, he hit his head on top of the tunnel and got knocked right off. Soldo's face is a twist of horrified compassion. She leans past the young man because she can see now beyond him that the wailing brother is back on his feet a third time. The words fly out of her mouth by instinct. Her hand darts toward him. Stop him, she screams. Grab him. But it's too late. The man has jumped. He's a distorted silhouette of egged arch arms and legs against the blurry yellow of the late morning sky. His shadow makes a shape of grief as it hurls toward the earth. Too far, it's too far. Silhouette's voice is still working independently of her body. Oh my god, oh my god. Their train car is already passing where the jumper has landed. His body rolls down the steep embankment and away. Luca counts his arms and legs. 1, 2, 3, 4. He counts them again to make sure. He still has all four, but they don't seem to be working. His body comes to a stop in a thicket of weeds, and the train storms on without him, without his brother. Soldo is almost catatonic after watching the man jump, as if the incident loosened the fragile scab of her own suffering. She lies down again, and Rebecca pulls her head to her lap. She strokes Soldo's long black hair back away from her forehead and quietly sings a song in a language Lydia has never heard before. Soldo stays there unblinking, but soon her expression softens, her dark eyebrows turn back slack, and her lids flutter closed. She drifts into some state akin to sleep. Lydia doesn't stare at the boy at the other end of the freight car, but she's hyper aware now of his attention. He sits with his legs outstretched and his weight leaned back on his propped hands, and he's watching them. Lydia does not recognize him now, but only because Luca mentioned it. He is wearing oversized red shorts and a huge white t-shirt. Over that, the giant red and black tank top jersey of some Russian vessel team and big diamond earrings in both ears. The jewelry is probably fake, but it does the trick to make him look like a hip-hop star, which is exactly the look he was hoping to achieve when he shaved those two tiny pinstripes into his right eyebrow. Lydia doesn't turn her head with the precision of a huntress. She can sense his movements with her peripheral vision when he lifts his flat-brimmed black baseball cap to scratch it beneath it, when he leans slightly over the edge of the train car to spit, when he unscrews the cap foam to a lip from his water bottle to take a drink. She wonders if he can feel her anxiety, if he studies her nonchalance as biologically ineffective, if her body is shooting off alarm pheromones he can detect. Her primal consciousness has sprung up between them, so she is aware too of the ways her own body responds when, on a long stretch of straight, open track, he lifts himself up from his position and moves toward them. Lydia's heartbeat increases, her pupils dilate, her grip on Luca tightens, indeed all her muscles either constrict or twitch, and her skin prickles with goosebumps. Her palms grow slick and clammy. She lets go of Luca and grabs at the cement shed strapped to her lower leg beneath her pants. Everyone watches the young man pick his way gingerly past the group of smugglers on the train top. Everyone always watches when someone is on the move. They look for signs of truculence or erratic behavior. They look for the gleam of the concealed blade. They're especially alert to this young man because it's so obvious what he is. They lean away from him as he passes. You looking for the cafe car, amigo? An older man in a straw hat asks him. The nearby migrants laugh with a suspicious laughter. Why is he alone? Why does he think he's going? Just stretching my legs, the young man answers. They keep an eye on a statue as it passes, confronting us a tiny facade. Most migrants understand the significance of those three drops of tattooed blood, one for each kip. Lydia pulls a machete from his holster and draws it out from beneath her pant leg. As the boy approaches, she presses a button to engage the blade and feels gratified by his appearance. Luca watches her lightly as she conceals it beneath her sleeve. Some soft flash of instinct advises Lydia to ditch the blade and watch instead for a passing bush for some soft landing point, and then to pitch her son from the drain as soon as she spots a place where he might survive the fall. She reaches over and briefly grabs his leg to make sure her body doesn't wildly obey that foolish impulse. She presses gravity onto his folded legs and presses grateful for the insurance of the canvas belt. The boy's shadow is upon them. Lydia doesn't look up. "Yo, I think I know you," he says. He puts his body down in the very small space between Lydia and the sisters. He squeezes in there, and if her body could tense up any further, it would. She can feel Rebecca trying to catch her eye, but she doesn't look at the girl because she doesn't want to draw her into whatever this is. Rebecca reshuffles her body, making room for the newcomer. And meanwhile, Lydia's brain has been so busy telling her to run that it failed to come up with a suitable plan for this moment, so she says the first words that show up in her mouth. "I didn't think so, but my son recognized you from back the road away outside Mexico City." She does not say the way I took her. In case the memory of his eviction from that place evokes his anger, she holds her body like a cocked gun. "Ah, see," he leans over to smile at Luca, which confuses Lydia. She can't understand the chit-chat. If he's a Sicario, then why is he plopped down there shooting the breeze? And where is his weapon inside all that abundant clothing? "What up, gooey?" he says to Luca. "Cool hat." He stretches such a brim of paper's red baseball cap that Luca moves out of his reach. "Anyway, I'm Lorenzo." He says, putting his hand out to Lydia. She's never been more reluctant to shake someone's hand, but she shakes it lightly. He retracts herself quickly, replacing a grip on the machete beneath her sleeve. "And you are? You can't be any older than 18, 20. Lydia thinks, "How is it that he speaks like this, as if she owes him her name, Araceli, and she expels the fake name on her breath like a surfer riding a dying tide. Lorenzo shakes his head. "I don't think so," Lydia bites the side of her mouth. If she ever doubted herself capable of saving another human being, that uncertainty is no more. "Pardon me, you're not Araceli." The only response she can manage is a soft snorting noise. Luca leans against it. When Lorenzo reaches into his pocket, she coils her body so tightly she begins to shake. She will thrust the blade into his neck, but no, she's in a bad position. There's no leverage. Would she be able to kill him? Or would she only injure him and cite him to repay her failed violence? It would be better to jump, to curl around Luca like a show, so at least he would survive this moment to leap from the speeding train. But could Luca survive whatever falls that once she's gone? Lydia will get only one opportunity to protect herself, and then Luca's on his own forever. Her body twitches, and with indecision, she turns the handle of the concealed machete cold against her palm, but then Lorenzo's hand emerges from his pocket with only a cell phone. No pistol, no blade. He clicks one of the things alive and scrolls through the pictures. Lydia's breast shudders for her. That's you, right? He turns the phone so she can see. It's a selfie Javier took of the two of them together at the bookstore. They're on top of the side of the counter, both leaning across their foreheads, touching at the temple. Lydia looks directly at the camera, but Javier's face is turned slightly in, his eyes pulled toward her. Lydia remembers the day he took it. Now he told her that Marta had instructed him thoroughly in the art of the selfie, how hard they had laughed her together. "Lydia Quijano Perez, right?" the boy beside her says. She tucks her lips inside her mouth and twists her neck once, but there's nothing even marginally convincing in the gesture. Lorenzo holds the phone up beside her best to check her features against the likeness. Yep, good looking folks, he says. And then in the voice that sounds uncannily sincere, "I'm sorry about your family." What passes for silence on the train is the slow motion roar of the engine hauling countless tons of chugging, clicking steel along the track behind it. The wheels shriek in their tracks, metal whines against metal, the couplers between the cars knuckle and grind and squeal. Several beats of that kind of silence pass before Lydia Brunswick. "What do you want, Lydia?" Lorenzo powers the phone off and puts it back in his pocket. "What do I want?" "Shoot," he whistles. same things as anybody, I guess. Nice house, a little bling, a good-looking girl. He turns and smiles at Rebecca, who's still sitting quite close to them, but doesn't seem to be listening. She doesn't meet his gaze and lets it down. She can hear the conversation over the noise of the train. Under left, Lydia's eyes are still closed. Lorenzo examines his nails, looking for one to bite, while Lydia watches. "What do you want from me?" she clarifies. He finds a tiny, unsalted white corner of fingernail and rips it off. With his teeth, he spits it over the edge. "Nothing," he shrugs, "just being neighborly." "Where did you get that picture?" Lydia scrunches up her nose and uses her chin to point in the direction of the phone in his pocket. "Maybe I hate to tell you," she says. Everybody in Guerrero got that picture. Lydia sucks in the breath. It's not exactly news, but it does validate her fear. For what purpose? She wants absolute clarity. Lorenzo smirks at her sideways. "For you for real? I need to know what you're up against." Lorenzo pauses. Then says, "Word was to bring you in." This is a surprise. Maybe only Hollywood gets to say things like dead or alive, but that was what she expected. She tries to push this information into her internal hard drive, but it doesn't compute. "Not to kill me," she asks. "To kill us?" On the side, this isn't how this government was supposed to go. She's not supposed to be the one asking the question. "Gooey," I said. "Too much already. I'm not trying to get myself killed, too." Lydia shifts uncomfortably beside him. The handle of the machete grows sweaty in her hand. "So that's why you're here, to bring us in. Maybe Javier wants always to kill them himself to witness her suffering. She and Luca will not go with this boy. She will kill him if she has to. She will do it in front of Luca if she must." "Nah," Lorenzo says. "I left all that behind me and Guerrero." He waves his arm toward the south. Lydia does not lose the grip on the machete. "Okay. Dave or Dodd, new leaf." He grins. "I'm out." She feels unqualified to assess his claim. She makes no response. "How'd you get out of Acapulco, though?" Lorenzo asks after a moment. "Everybody was looking for you. You got magic powers or something? You some kind of Santera? Una bruja?" Lydia surprises herself with a laugh. There's only a husk of a sound. "I suppose fear has certain magical properties." She'll never know how narrow their escape really was. That two of Javier's men opened the door to their room at the Hotel Duquesa Imperial, just as she and Luca were entering the lobby of the hotel next. "So, where are you heading now?" Lorenzo asks. "I don't know," she lies. "We haven't really decided." Lorenzo pulls his knees up to his baggy shorts sag beneath. He gathers his arms around his legs. "I'm going to L.A., he says. "I'm going to cousin out there in Hollywood doing his thing. "As good a place as any," she says. And then the train silence returns. And in that thundering quiet, she saw wonders. Why, if he was well-connected in those hard enough, if he was making enough money to afford those expensive tickets and that decent cell phone, if he was okay with earning that first drop of tattooed blood, and the second, and the third, and then what made him leave? Where? There are infinite possible answers, she knows. Perhaps he disliked murdering, perhaps he felt the acts of violence he committed had some undesirable effect on him. Perhaps he had nightmares with faces of people he killed floating up before him whenever he closed his eyes. Maybe he was haunted, hunted, ragged in his soul, or maybe the precise opposite was true. Perhaps he was so entirely without conscience that he'd been unable even to adhere to whatever the form of excuse for a moral code those hardy narrows exercised. Maybe he raped the wrong woman or stole money from one of his jefes, or maybe he murdered so gleefully that his department turned him into a liability. Maybe he's running too, or maybe none of these are true. Perhaps he hasn't left Hordenet at all, and he really is here only for her. Whatever the case, Lydia feels thrilled by Lorenzo's presence. He's a menace sitting beside her, and now the threat feels urgent again. It's all around her. She breathes it, and it's the same as ever. Since it's confusing, categorically terrifying, Javier feels as close as the day she first confronted him in the bookshop. The Russian nesting dolls, he'd reached for her hand. He can feel his fingers pressing into the vein at her wrist. She can hear the Sakara urinating into the toilet on the other side of Abella's green tile wall. A lady wishes this boy would move away from them. 9 days and 426 miles from their escape, they haven't made any headway at all. Thank you for listening to this chapter. Have a good day and stay safe.